Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We have Larry still with us. We're going to return to our presentation of matzah. I'd like to reprise the initial statements that Yah made introducing this date, and then, as we like to do on this program, examine some of the words that he chose more closely so that we come to understand the nature of the party, of the celebration that Yahweh is inviting us to attend. It begins, these godly appointed meeting times of Yahweh are set apart. They're invitations to be called out and meet for the relationship and for our benefit, for us to be welcomed, approaching with them at their appointed time. You see, all of these dates, the seven of them, exist for a singular purpose, for our benefits, so that we can approach God. In the first month, which is Abib, and month is Kodesh, time of renewal, on the 14th day of the month, for the purpose of understanding, at twilight, is Passover, according to Yahweh. Yahweh, at this point, does not describe the nature of Passover, its purpose, or how we should respond to this invitation, because he has already done so. He did so in the book called Names, Shemoth, which we have corrupted to Exodus. So then, the narrative from the Creator of the Universe continues. So if you wish to discount any of this, understand that your animosity should not be directed at me for presenting this to you. It shouldn't be against Larry, because Larry already gets enough animosity directed at him. He has his full quotient. It should be directed at God. So if you don't like what I'm saying here, we're just the messenger. Don't shoot the messenger. So then...
You did say, for the purposes of what? Of understanding? Is that right?
Yeah, I said for the purpose of understanding. The Hebrew word there is bien. Bien has a primary meaning and a secondary meaning. Its primary meaning is to understand. It's used throughout the 119th Psalm, for example, which is the ode to the Torah. It's the longest psalm. It's one written by Dode, whose name we've corrupted to David, means love. And he wrote a song that has 22 choruses in it, refrains in it, because there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. He wrote the song in alphabetical order, talking about the nature of the Torah from the perspective of the 22 letters that comprise the words that are in the Torah. And throughout it, he tells us that the purpose of observing the Torah is so that we can understand God's teaching. Bien's secondary meaning is between. And so you can read this as in the first month, on the 14th day of the month, between twilight is Passover according to Yahweh. And that's the way it reads in most English translations. Although that's pretty consistent with most English translations. They will translate bien as between. Makes no sense to say between there. And the primary meaning of the word.
Twilight.
Right. And the primary meaning of the word makes perfect sense there. Bien is for the purpose of understanding. And so, in the first month, on the 14th day of the month, for the purpose of understanding at twilight, is Passover, according to Yahweh.
We're trying to understand.
Yeah, that's
Shamar.
That's why the Torah is comprised of instructions to be learned as opposed to laws to be obeyed. So then God says, the 15th day of this same month is the festival feast, the chag of unyeasted bread, matzah, unto and to approach Yahweh. 7 days you shall eat bread without yeast. So on the 15th day of the same time of renewal, Kodesh, is a celebration, a party. Mm-hmm. So if this is a party that God is inviting to, is it a solemn occasion?
Nope.
Are we being asked to make a sacrifice?
No.
No. It's a party, isn't
act
it?
Act religiously what, at all?
No. What, so if it is a party, what is it? If God's inviting us to a party, does it perhaps tell us a little bit about the nature, the personality, the attitude of God?
Yeah, it's time to have a good time. Have a couple of laughs, eat,
right.
Share information.
Yeah, the only way that you can translate chag is festival, feast, celebration, or party. And it means all four of those things. So this unyeasted bread is a celebration. And it's a celebration to all. All means to approach Yahweh. 7 days, you shall have the opportunity to eat bread without yeast. Now, you think that God just says, you know, I've got a thing against yeast. Let's just ban it because I don't have the market cornered on yeast. You know, the adversaries, the yeast producer. No. It's that bread is always used as the symbol, the grain for bread. As a matter of fact, the first month is known, God tells us, because of Abib. The kernel in the barley plant, which is the world's first principal source of grain, both for breads and for beers, fermented alcohol, which without beer there would be no civilization. Beer literally made civilization possible, and it's and yeast is an ingredient in the beer. What God is saying here is that barley, the grain in barley is symbolic of a saved soul. It's something that is nourishing, and it's Aviv. It is pliable. It is still growing. It is receptive. And so in the month of Aviv, when the barley kernel is in the bud and still green and pliable and flexible and receptive, still growing, that's the time. That's the first month. And on the 14th day of the month is Passover, and the 15th is unleavened bread. And, of course, it's at sundown. Now, sundown on the 14th day is actually the 13th day from our accounting because we measure days differently. Because that the sunset of the 14th day is actually the beginning of the 15th day. So, but you say you do know have to understand God's timeline as it relates to these events. And he says this is the opportunity for us to party. And he wants us to have this bread, which is symbolic of saved souls, without yeast. Yeast is a fungus. It permeates the entire loaf of bread. And God is saying that this fungus should be removed from the bread for these 7 days, because the entire purpose of unleavened bread is to remove the corruption, the fungus, if you will, of sin from our souls so we appear perfect in God's eyes. And so the reason that unleavened bread is a party to approach Yahweh is because once we become immortal on Passover, once we become perfected as it relates to unleavened bread, then we are properly prepared to come into the presence of, to approach Yahweh. So unleavened bread is a step that we take to approach Yahweh. It's amazing then that one-tenth of 1% of the world's population, maybe even less than that, answer this invitation. There's no other way to approach God. God says, this is the way to approach me. No other path. And is it 0.01% of the world's population that celebrates this day?
Probably.
Meets with God, answers his invitation? There's no other way to come into God's presence. None. Now, since it is the essence of the issue, it's worth repeating. The Passover sacrifice was designed to free us from the consequence of sin, which is death, while unleavened bread is symbolic of the removal of sin from our souls, thereby freeing us from the penalty of sin, which is separation from God. It also should be said with great clarity here that Passover, unleavened bread, and Bukurim, first fruits, are not separate events. They're all unified. They're a unified whole. And any time that you would answer one invitation but not the other, it is counterproductive. You either answer the invitation and participate in all three, or you should not do any of the three. Because if you become immortal because you observed Passover, but you do not take advantage of God's invitation to be perfected on matzah, then you're going to spend your eternity in Sheol.
Separated.
Yeah, because you're going to be immortal, but still full of sin. You'll be eternally separated from God. That's the worst possible circumstance. If you were to be perfected but not immortal, what good does it do? What's the purpose of that? You're still going to die. You're still going to die. And what value would it be to become immortal, to become perfect, and not be able to grow, to not be able to share in the in God's family? And that's what First Fruits is all about, is us being adopted into God's family. You can't be adopted into God's family without taking these first two steps. And if you take the first two steps but don't capitalize on the third, it leads nowhere. You'll be estranged from the very source of joy. The Creator wants to have a festival feast, a celebration, a party with us for all eternity. That's what heaven is. It's a constant celebration, a party, 24/7, if you will, with God.
Well, that's
now,
rough.
Chon, yeah, it's rough. Now, chon is an interesting term here. It is almost always translated feast or festival because those are its primary meaning. But its roots suggest that there is a flip side to chag, and that is true of many, many Hebrew words. And it's all really because all of these things are choices. There's a benefit if you embrace what God is offering, and there's a consequence if you reject it. And in the case of unleavened bread, while it is a celebration for us, it was the most miserable time in all of universal history for God himself. Passover is the one that everyone thinks of, well, you know, the human manifestation of God, the diminished corporeal presence of God, was beaten to a pulp and then nailed to an upright pole on Mount Moriah, and that was torturous, where mankind killed his body as the sacrificial lamb. That would have been the most
beating that the family deserved.
Right, and so this is what is considered as the sacrifice, but that was nothing compared to what happened next. On Matzah, yes, on Matzah, his soul was separated and went into Sheol to be tormented so that our souls would not be tormented. So when we return, we're going to consider the flip side of chag because it is what God had to endure so that we would endure its benefits. I've got it. This is Shattering Myths back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We're here with Larry. We're having a discussion about the nature of chag because Yahweh told us that on the 15th day of this same month, it happens to be the month that we're in right now, it's called Abib, from Yah's perspective, he said it is a festival feast. It is a chag, a celebration of unyeasted bread, of matzah. Unto and to approach Yahweh, 7 days you shall eat bread without yeast. And I mentioned that chag is a provocative term because every concept like this has a different consequence depending upon who we're talking about and whether or not we avail ourselves of the benefit or not. So the most respective lexicons define chag as a genuine expression of relief, which turns to spontaneous joy that one experiences once they realize that against all odds, they have escaped from a long and seemingly hopeless ordeal. You know, a lot of times, Larry, I'm confronted by those who, poisoned by Paul, think that the Torah is a mean-spirited, legalistic document that condemns, that unless you can obey everything, every law in the Torah, you're condemned by the Torah. Now, mind you, the Torah does not mean law, it means teaching, and there is no Hebrew word for obey, but truth has never gotten in the way of religious zealots' proclamations. Yeah, nor law. So here we are with this word suggesting that the purpose of this party is to exonerate those who are hopelessly guilty. And so I look at the Torah, and I look at unyeasted bread, the same way that God presents it. That the Torah is not a document which enslaves me. It's not a document that convicts me. It's the document that vindicates
me. Frees you.
It's the document. Yeah, it's my tickets to freedom. It's not laws to be obeyed and to be constrained by. It's liberty. It's being said, I know you're flawed. You know, I know who you are.
Yeah.
And so I have a...
The living Torah is dead.
Right.
Imagine that.
So I have a plan here to make you look perfect. I got a plan here to buff you all up and to make you look absolutely perfect. And that is the entire nature of the Torah. The Torah is guidance.
Which is where you get into the second meaning of that that word shag,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's that. Yeah. As such, it's used to convey of the idea of gathering together to celebrate a pilgrimage, a journey which leads from oppression to safety in God's presence. God said it right here. He said that the purpose of this celebration was for us to approach God because it takes us out of hopelessness. It takes us away from being corrupted, and it makes us perfect in God's eyes. You know,
right.
Chag commemorates the completion of a terrifying sacrificial act, is the other side of Chag.
Right.
No, we're not making it
right to Yasha Yahu, where he says,
right.
and Psalms, but correct me if I'm wrong, where he's in Sheol.
Right.
And he has to fight to get to the daylight, to get to the light. Yeah.
We have the only expression of what happened in year 4000 in Yah, 33 CE, that gives us the whole story, not only of the fulfillment of Pesach, of Passover, through crucifixion as the sacrificial lamb, what happened that night to his body, which was incinerated, and the next day, where his soul is incarcerated in Sheol to be tormented, that to be the ransom for our sin, that for this commemoration of this terrifying sacrificial act, which is part of the meaning of Chag, the place where there is an eyewitness account of what happened those 2 days, and then the third day when Yahusha's soul was reunited with Yahweh's spirit on Bukurim, a celebration of first fruits. There's only one eyewitness account of this, and you don't find it in the so-called Christian New Testaments. You don't find it there. Where you find the eyewitness account, you're correct. It's in the prophet Yeshayahu and in the Psalms that were ascribed by Dode, the 22nd and the 88th. They provide a moment-by-moment narrative from the perspective of an eyewitness and the perspective of the participant in this act, God himself. And it tells you exactly what he endured on matzah to make this party possible. And he's not asking us. You know, you go into a Roman Catholic cathedral and it's ghoulish because the central thing is the picture of a man nailed to a pagan cross in anguish. And God is saying, you know, I don't want you to focus on what I endured. I endured it for you because I wanted to party with you, because I wanted to make you perfect so that I could celebrate eternity with you. You should put a smile on our face. Mr. Shatterin, this time your host, Jetta. We're here with Larry having a discussion of the festival feast, the Chag, known as Unleavened Bread, that we are invited to celebrate with Yahweh. It is a day, a time, actually, because it lasts for 7 days, with a very important purpose. It is the day that we are perfected so that we can enter God's presence. So, as such, Chag's etymology, which is the study of the word's roots, it's the word's development, its meaning, hints at a sacrifice, and the sacrifice that Yahusha is the diminished corporeal manifestation of Yahweh, made on this very day. It was a Shabbat, a Sabbath, the day after Pesach, Passover, when his soul descended into Sheol to be afflicted on our behalf by allowing his soul to be separated from Yah's spirit. That's why he said, as he breathed his last, my God, why have you forsaken me? He was actually quoting from the 22nd Psalm, telling us where we should go to understand what was happening at this point. So
because Sheol is defined by a lack of presence of Yahweh's spirit. So the spirit it was home. It went home. Boom.
Right.
And then he said, why have you forsaken me? Because what we have now is just nephesh, a man with consciousness. And then his soul descends to Sheol, which is described really more horribly than the crucifixion is.
Of course. He's you can tell that there's torment associated with the crucifixion. In fact, all of the elements of crucifixion are delineated in the 22nd and 88th Psalms. They speak of the horror of crucifixion in great detail. I mean, this is this was written 500 years before the Assyrians invented crucifixion through tying the arms and hands to a upright pole, and about 1,000 years before the Romans improved the torture through driving nails through the wrists and through the feet. And so 1,000 years before, the form of crucifixion that he would endure as the sacrificial lamb was even invented. There is a vivid depiction of right to the details of exactly the torment of crucifixion, every element of it, where you're dying of thirst and yet you're drowning in your own body fluids. They fill your lungs. You can't breathe because you can't push up with your on your legs. The way that your arms are hanging, you eventually end up unable to push up, and when you can't do that and you're just hanging from the weight of your arms, your diaphragm doesn't work, you can't breathe. You end up suffocating and drowning in your own fluids, and your heart and your energy just literally melts away inside of you. And
which is why when they wanted to get it over, what they did was broke their legs, because instead of being able to push up to breathe, you wouldn't be able to do that anymore. Your legs would be broken.
Right. It ends the torment, and most crucifixion victims have their legs broken. That was not the case with Yahusha. It said that it wouldn't be the case. And so there's this vivid depiction of exactly how crucifixion torments and kills. And then it's followed by an even more gruesome presentation of how the adversary was enabled to torment Yahusha's soul in Sheol, the place of separation, on matzah, so that our souls would be freed by paying a ransom for the sins that we had committed. Now, this is God's plan of salvation. It is His source of mercy.
What it says there is, when as a concession He will render His soul as a guilt for sin.
Correct.
And He will appear and see His offspring. He will prolong His days. And He will... the days and the will of Yahweh will be advanced, coming mightily forth in His hand.
Right. You're reading God's testimony of what He did on our behalf. And that's
out of
that's
the toil, His soul will see light and He will find satisfaction. Now, there's a lot of people out here now, too, I want to point this out, Yada, that are saying that nobody can accept the sins of no man can accept the sins of another man. Well, guess what, folks? A man didn't do it.
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah. A man didn't do it. A man's body, as the sacrificial lamb, was killed on the upright pole of Mount Moriah on Passover, in accordance with Passover. But all that did is deal with our mortality. The way that God resolved the consequence of our sin to remain just Himself is that He paid the penalty. He took His soul to the place of separation, so that He could endure our penalty. And He was perfect. Why was He perfect? Because He observed the Torah. And so, as a perfect observer of the Torah, He was able to take our sins, our fungus, the yeast, upon Himself. And He took that upon Himself and went and paid the penalty for it in Sheol on Matzah. This is Yahusha's soul that did this. While the Spirit had to leave the man, because the Spirit of God cannot die. Man cannot kill God. God cannot die. God did not die for our sins. The body died. The body was was incinerated that night, and his soul went into Sheol. And there's a vivid depiction of it. God's last words on the upright pole, my God, why have you forsaken me, tells us to read the 22nd Psalm, and yet no one wants to do that. They want to celebrate a pagan festival of Easter instead of answering this invitation. And I want to tell you that even if you were to correctly identify Easter with Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits, and you understand of the sacrifice of Passover, and you celebrated that, you become immortal, but you're still corrupted, which means that you're going to be eternally separated from God. It's the worst of all possible outcomes. The religion of Christianity, with its focus on the crucifixion, is the worst of all possible outcomes, because your soul now is immortal, but is he still corrupted because it did not answer the invitation to participate in matzah?
Thus has to be separated.
Right. You did say something as you were reading Jan's testimony regarding his choice to participate in matzah in this way. Is that this was his will. It was his decision. It was something that he wanted to do. That's the reason why he wants us to embrace what was the most horrible day for him with great joy. Because, it's like a loving father. When you make a sacrifice that is painful for you, for your son or daughter, but you can see that the opportunity and the life that brought your son or daughter, and the enjoyment of the benefit of what you have done for them, endures forever.
And so, as a good son or daughter, you would want to acknowledge the fact that your father did this for you, and you would want to embrace that, and you would probably even brag about it. Really.
Right. Certainly celebrate it. Certainly celebrate it, and this is the most important day each year on the calendar. Is the celebration of unleavened bread. It is a celebration of what God did on our behalf. And yet, in the religious mindset of Christians who mistakenly think that they are following their misnomer Jesus Christ, they've got no concept whatsoever what he did on Saturday, on the Sabbath. It's like he took the day off.
They're doing the work. They're doing the work because it's out of their great faith and their incredible faith and belief that they're going to have their salvation, which doesn't have anything to do with it.
I was dealing with a rewrite of Questioning Paul yesterday. A good friend of yours and mine, Chuck, has devoted enormous energies to adding things that I should, suggesting things I should add to Questioning Paul in the midst of doing that. And one of the things that I mentioned, because Paul was in this review, was acting very egotistically, is that I should actually quote the passage where Paul himself says that when he is being attacked and tormented because anybody with a right mind knew he was an idiot, that he said that his sufferings completed the work of Yahusha.
That his
sufferings completed that work. That so what he was is that God himself couldn't complete the job, and he needed Paul to come in to complete the job. And so Paul was putting himself not just on par with the Messiah, but as better than the Messiah, because Paul was able to complete the job. It's one of the most grotesquely arrogant, beguiling statements in the whole of of Paul's letters.
But doesn't that really advance a lot of religious notions, like
sure,
where you earn salvation, where you I'm willing to sacrifice, I'm willing to make a sacrifice. You've heard these things.
Yeah.
Of course, whatever sacrifice you're willing to make. I read once in a book where a fellow was talking about when he went to a college or something, he could, for 50 cents, buy a beer out of a beer machine, and a guy took him to a dinner, that $200, $300 dinner, whatever, big dinner, and at the end he threw 50 cents up on the table to help cover the tip.
It's that kind of attitude. And God is saying, I did it all. I did everything that was necessary to exonerate you.
I have nothing to add.
There is nothing to add. There's nothing more that needs to be done other than one thing.
Understand it.
Yeah, understand it and respond to it. Appreciate it. Celebrate it. You know,
be thankful for it.
Your creator,
don't try to outdo him. It ain't going to be done.
Your creator and God did everything that was necessary to liberate you and me, to exonerate you and me.
About Paul's amazing.
And so
Chuck's brilliant to see those things. I can't read Paul. He's so full of himself. I mean, he just advances all kinds of notions that are just completely untrue. And anybody listening to this radio show, if you have any doubt, that should have finished right there. Any thought about Paul being real?
You know, on a different show, a show that we do on Fridays. You did it for me while I was on vacation last Friday, and I'll resume this Friday. I hope you can join me this Friday evening.
We're doing
Blog Talk Radio on what's called Yada Yada Radio, and we've been talking about a prophecy that Yahweh made regarding Paul that he wrote in a book called Habakkuk. That's a book most people don't even know is one of the prophetic books in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And he calls out Paul by name, and he absolutely tells us that this man will be the most destructive force in human history. And he says that those who follow the broad path that Paul has deceptively crafted will find no satisfaction. And he goes to great lengths to warn us about Sheol, who is the man we know as Paul. Something to consider. Well, welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths for today. I may have misspoke at the end of the last segment. Yada Yada Radio is this evening for those who would like to listen. We have been devoting our time to a presentation of Habakkuk. We may continue that this evening, but it's always an hour and a half on Friday evenings that is devoted to studying Yah's testimony. Masa, which is the name of this particular day that we are now coming to understand, is more than just a term for unleavened bread or bread without yeast. Masa speaks of rebellion and contentiousness. It's the very thing that must be removed from our nature for us to live as children in our Heavenly Father's household. And it is important to keep this concept of rebellion in mind because it is listed as the specific burden that Yahusha's soul removed from us on this day. That is what Yah's testimony prophetically describes. You know, when Yahusha was taking a little boat ride with his disciples, and he wanted them to understand matzah, what unleavened bread represents, he asked them about yeast. And they responded, you know, kind of like we humans are, kind of dumbfounded. And they say, wait a minute, oh, yeah, daggone it, we forgot to bring some bread. Let's go back and we'll get some bread because, you know, we're going to want to eat lunch. We're going to get hungry out here. And Yahusha said, oh, come on, you idiots. He really did have kind of an interesting style. And you just imagine that God saying, I've been with you for 2.5 years. And you don't have this figured out? Listen, if I wanted bread, don't you think that I could just make bread? I mean, you've seen me do it before. Why? Well, I'm not telling you to go back and get bread. I'm trying to explain what unleavened bread is all about and what the yeast represents. And then he explained what yeast represents, what is being removed from our souls on unleavened bread. And he equated yeast with two groups of people.
Yeah, Pharisees Sadducees.
Yeah, the Sadducees. Yeah, and the reason he did that, it's because these scribes and the Sadducees, they represented liberal political thought, governance, if you will, academia to a large degree. And the Pharisees represented religion. And he says, so what I'm removing from you here is religion and politics.
Babylonian concepts.
Babylonian concepts. It's the very thing that, you know, it ties right into the preamble of the covenant. God says, before you can walk with me, before you can come into my home, you first have to walk away from Babylon, from religion and politics. And so here's God in human form, in corporeal form, telling his disciples what the purpose of unleavened bread is. Do you think there's a Christian on the planet that listens to him?
No. No, I don't. Or they wouldn't be Christian anymore. I mean, they'd have to walk away from their religion.
They would. You know, it was amazing. Yesterday I was having continued dialogue with the guy that you must have called an idiot. The term was appropriate in his particular case. But and one of these days when we have a break, I will present these letters. But was quite interesting is that he wanted to base salvation. Salvation, for his point of view, was on being nice. If you're not nice, if you don't speak nicely to others, you can't be saved. You'll be condemned. And if you do speak nicely, then you are saved. And so
it was almost satanic in nature.
Yeah, yeah. And what he decided to quote to me was a line from Matanya 23, which is where Yosha spends about 10 minutes berating the Pharisees, the religious establishment. He's also talking to the scribes and Sadducees, the liberal political establishment. And for 10 minutes, if you read this, he just labels them with every filthy, disgusting label that that is possible.
Calls them out for the whores that they are.
Right. And it's just because he's opposed to religion and politics. And and the hypocrisy of the whole thing. So this fellow, to express his proof that it is the means to salvation is in being nice and speaking nicely to people.
Uses the
labels me with the with gnat strainer and camel swallower, which was some of the pejorative terms that Yosha used to describe the religious and political establishment of his day, and he didn't have the rational capability of processing the fact that, wait a minute, if Yosha was labeling these people and speaking mean to them, then would not he be condemned? Was he not following the undermining the very presence and purpose that this person was advocating? No, we need to understand his words because they are the means to our reconciliation and salvation.